Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Hi there, I'm Greg from Kapow. Visit us at kapow.com to check out our unique collection of everyday reusable products designed to help you do more with less. C-U-P-P-O-W.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 178 of The Morning After. I'm your host, Leslie Stockton. Sari Kamen is not with us today. She will be back next week, and she is missed. In the studio today are Todd Misonis and Greg Delisander of Dandelion Chocolate. Welcome. But first, a word. The Morning After is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Please help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. Do it now, please. They're going to turn off the lights if you don't donate. But first, we're going to have the food news before any lights go out. Okay, boys, how are you?
Phenomenal.
Okay, are you ready for some food news?
Let's do it.
All right. So according to the New York Daily News, during a routine inspection at a Brooklyn candy store for illegal untaxed cigarettes, because that's a thing, they fall off a truck in Virginia and magically like pop up in Brownsville, police found a secret door that led to a giant heroin processing operation. They removed 50 large bags of cocaine, 24 bags of heroin, a million glassine bags used to package heroin, and a large quantities of fentanyl, which killed Prince, the singer. So won't anybody think of the children? Would this ever happen in San Francisco?
My first question is why my partner didn't call me to tell me the police raided.
Exactly. Because you guys are in chocolate. When did that happen?
Well, we've always wanted a secret door in the back of our factory. I think we would just put something else back there.
Exactly. Well, you know, the two men who were arrested, like, we just started working here. We had no idea this massive heroin operation. Listen, that could be your story. You're like, guys, we just make chocolate.
Yeah. Is that why the hundreds of people go through this store every day? I was curious. I just never knew why they did that.
And that's just like old school Brooklyn. Like, you get weed from the ice cream truck, you know, and you get lots of heroin from a candy store. Won't someone please think of the children? All right. Second, according to Grub Street, a restaurant chain in Japan unveiled a Ghostbusters menu. It's complete with an absurdly tall, multi-layered burger that has, like, you know how in Japan they're obsessed with like black food? It has the black bun, and here's a picture of it. I'm just going to describe it for our listeners. It looks like it has like chili sauce dipped chicken patties on top of a beef patty with some purple cabbage and like marshmallow and some sort of like olive sauce, and that's not it. They have an ectoplasm smoothie that is green, has kiwi and topped with like mini hamburgers, because isn't that what the slimy ghost like to just like eat hamburgers and hot dogs? Is that true?
Well, right? I was thinking they could serve the hamburger and then jump out at you and throw slime all over you while you're eating it as an integrated activity.
I think, you know, I would really like more interaction with my food other than me eating it. But look at this dessert. Look at that white bun. God. Isn't that magical?
Yeah,
it's a white bun with marshmallow and a ton of Oreos. And just, I mean, look at that thing.
It's amazing.
Thank you, David. Okay, last one. According to Grub Street, Reddit user Mr_Scorpion promised to eat the worst Subway sandwich anyone could think of. In the comments section, there were some guidelines, though. Must have one kind of meat. Any salads and extra meat/cheese are fair game, except red onion. I'm allergic. Only two kinds of sauces max, please. There is a limit at my local store. Also, I don't want to die. That's not the funny part. The funny part about this is the comments that he got. It was just a beautiful, poetic dumpster fire that is the world of internet commenters, especially Reddit commenters. This guy, or woman, who knows? The best suggestion was, get the wheat bread. Insist that they, quote, lube it up, son. First by slathering copious amount of mayo on both sides to the point where you can't see the bread anymore. Then you get him to toast it on 3. I don't know what that means.
Oh.
Add cold meatballs and you're good to go.
I like the idea that Subway sandwiches are turned into an art form, that people have this, like, you know, like I've done this 437 times and you need number 3, because if you do number 4, then clearly, you know, the whole thing goes to, you know,
it all goes to bad. The thing is, this commenter obviously worked at Subway.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of the commenters were sandwich artists or former sandwich artists. But I think even though the lube it up son was pretty good, another commenter said, walk in and ask for a wheat bread with salt. Just have them pour on the salt until they're worried for your health and refuse to add more. Toast it, of course. Okay, so my question for you is, what would be your nightmare Subway sandwich? And you can't say any of them.
And do you mean like Subway the store or
Subway the
transportation organization?
Well, the transportation organization would be any sandwich I would find on the Subway. But are you familiar?
Oh, I know. I haven't been there in years, but I'm not much of a vegetable eater, so pretty much... half the menu is no go for me.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, well, that's why we have a chocolate factory, because I never ate my vegetables.
San Francisco couldn't produce enough food without vegetables for Todd, so we needed to have a chocolate factory to produce more.
Okay, so what if, like, someone made you a sandwich with, like, salami, like, raw cookie dough, and some mustard with no vegetables? Would you try it?
Yeah, I'd try it.
Yeah.
That cookie dough sounds pretty good.
What about you?
So I don't eat meat. So Todd gets all the meat and I get all the vegetables.
All the vegetables, no turkey. Cookie dough.
Exactly. My favorite was in India. We went to India for sourcing cacao. And in India, the Subway is mostly vegetable stuff. And they have like 2 meat options. It's like totally flipped and I was in heaven.
That's the Subway amazing. Of my dreams.
Yeah, it was incredible. And most of those options tasted good.
Yeah, I heard that Subway is lovely in, across the oceans in other countries. But I will say, a veggie delight is my jam.
It is your delight.
It is my delight, and it's one of my favorite sandwiches on the planet. So, sorry, haters. Love you, Subway.
But what kind of bread?
Oh, the honey oat.
Please. Yeah.
Come on.
If you can put a little honey into a bread, I'll eat it.
Oh.
A little sweetness in my bread.
Mustard and mayo. I love it all. All right. That's it for Food News. We'll be back. Todd Misonis is CEO and co-founder of Dandelion Chocolate. A veteran of 10 years in the tech industry, Todd founded Dandelion Chocolate with Cameron Ring after Todd started making chocolate from scratch in his San Francisco home. Soon enough, Dandelion expanded from underground markets and a garage production space to a full factory and cafe in San Francisco's Mission District. Greg D'Alessandro is VP of Research and Development and chocolate sourcer of Dandelion Chocolate. He began working with chocolate in college, making liquid nitrogen truffles from, quote, borrowed equipment in the physics lab. He is now part owner of the company and travels around the world searching for quality cacao or cocoa. What is it, please?
That's the debate.
First,
of the
let me
century.
Say welcome. Oh, welcome,
thanks,
gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
So can we just talk about that? Can we spend no more than 2 minutes on the cacao cocoa debate?
You got it. I'm going to give you what I heard from the guys in Trinidad at UE, which is this research institute. And so I trust them because they research things. They said cacao is the tree. Cocoa is the product from the tree. So as soon as it is no longer a viable seed, once it's fermented, it goes from being cacao to being cocoa.
Okay, so when the bean is cut off the tree, it's still when the pod's cut off the tree, it's still cacao.
Exactly.
When you're cracking it open, it's still cacao. Fermentation happens, it's now cocoa. Yeah. Okay.
You know a lot about the cutting of the pod and the cracking of the pod. That's
I've
impressive.
Done a lot of research on chocolate. But I just don't make it. So what you guys are a San Francisco-based chocolate company. So what are you doing in New York City right now?
So we're actually out here for the Fine Chocolate Industry Association conference. And this is a conference that happens around the same time as the Fancy Food Show. But it's sort of an opportunity for the small chocolate makers from all over the country and actually all over the world now. And cocoa bean farmers, machine vendors, everyone to get together and talk and hang out. It's kind of a really good industry where everyone's super friendly with each other. And so this is our excuse twice a year to get together and say hello and share tips and tricks.
There's no, like, big time rivalries in the bean to bar?
Not really.
The only rivalries are end up being, like, who can yell loudest at the bar that night. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the kind of rivalries you get into.
How do I get into your business? That's what I want to know. I did say bean to bar, and we have covered it on this show, but let's talk about Dandelion, and it is a bean to bar company, and what does that mean, and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, bean to bar, it's pretty simple. It means we start with beans, cocoa beans, and we make bars of chocolate. And you'd think that'd be something you wouldn't have to specify, but, you know, 15-ish years ago, basically, there was almost no bean to bar chocolate in America. No one was really making chocolate from the bean on a small scale. I think when we started, there was maybe a handful of companies in America actually making chocolate from the beans. Now, I think the last count, there was over 100 within America alone. Recently, I was in Tokyo. You know, 2 years ago, there was no bean to bar in Tokyo. Last trip, there were 8 stores with their own, you know, factories and cafes. And so kind of like what happened to microbrew and has happened to coffee is happening to chocolate right now. There's this huge explosion of people actually going and getting good beans, bringing back and making chocolate.
All right. It's I love how the Japanese like pick up on things on like artisanal American trends, because when I hate to generalize, but when the Japanese get a hold of something, they make it so good. They take every single step of the process and dissect it and look at it and scrutinize it and just fine-tune every single possible thing you can. So what is are the Japanese bars any different than our bars, or are they kind of the same?
Oh, that's a great question. So we actually just opened a factory and cafe in Tokyo a couple months ago. So we've been thinking about this a lot, because we're basically, what we have in San Francisco is a factory and a cafe. We built the same thing in Tokyo, and so it's the same beans, the same process. You know, we have a new team that we're training. But the thing that's fascinating is we always do taste tests to figure out what makes the best chocolate. We taste it. We do roast, and we taste, and we roast, and we taste until we get the right flavor. But what's fascinating is even from being, you know, there in the first day, the flavor profiles are very different. Flavors that we tend to like, you know, nutty flavors, a lot of Japanese people aren't super familiar with those flavors and they don't like them. Or the ones that, like, I personally did a bunch of taste tests and I didn't like some of the more fermenty flavors, and they'd say, oh, this tastes like miso, or this tastes like something I hadn't tried before. And so it'll be really interesting to see how our Japanese operation evolves, because the flavor is going to be very, very different than our American one.
So what flavor notes in chocolate are actually favored for Japanese palates? What are they like, more like fruity notes?
I think it was more fermenty is what
fermenty.
I saw.
Fermenty, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly flavors I had never really spent much time with or hadn't thought were good flavors. I was surprised when everyone was like, oh, yeah, I totally recognize flavor. This is amazing. So it's pretty different.
I think part of it also is in Japan, a lot of food is... people are used to food that has intense flavors, whereas I think in the U.S. there's a lot more muted flavors in a lot of the food. And so our chocolate, what we've always tried to do is make bars with super intense flavors in them. And I think that's one of the reasons people very quickly were like, oh, this is really interesting and this is really great in Japan. Whereas I think some people in the U.S. will try our chocolate and be like, oh, this is like too much. Like, I don't know if I'm into this, but I think much in the same way in microbrews, sours are a thing now, which was like unthinkable 20 years ago. Now suddenly everyone loves them. And I think that's happening with chocolate too.
Yeah. I love to see how the American palate is like slowly evolving. And, and our food is still a little bit bland, but that's our English lineage. You can't turn the ship overnight. So you guys are like one of the darlings of the, you know, small, you really are of the small artisanal chocolate movement. And success hit you guys really fast. I mean, you know, when you think about how long, like Valrhona and, you know, Calibo and I know I'm not saying that right, but what is it like in the beginning being one of like the most sought after bars, chocolate bars in the country, not being able to supply everyone who is asking for them? And how do you deal with that like emotional tug of war?
Yeah, I think honestly, we feel pretty bad. We have our wholesale person and he calls himself a customer disappointment manager because all he does all day is get phone calls and says, sorry, we don't have any more chocolate. That's it. That's all we have. That's all we can make. And so, you know, we didn't start the company because it's just like, oh, like, you know, we got some Excel spreadsheets and said, how are we going to make the most money? We're, you know, millennials like stories and millennials like we didn't do any of that. We started the company because we like chocolate and this is something we wanted to do. We wanted it to exist in the world. We wanted it to be awesome. And then as people found out about it, we've been pleasantly surprised that they like our chocolate, that they like our story, they like what we're doing. And so we would like to do more of it. And we feel bad every time we can't supply chocolate. So we're just on a sort of constant quest to make more chocolate. But at the same time, we don't want to just make more chocolate and have it taste bad. We want to make more chocolate that actually, as we increase in scale, tastes better than today. So we're always sort of challenging ourselves to do more.
So you do have a fancy new factory. It's not that new, right?
Well, it's not even done yet.
Oh, it's not even done yet.
Yeah, so
it's still out of the...
Yeah, so, I mean, basically, for the last 2 years, we've done nothing but try to work on this new factory. And you'd think, oh, no big deal, just get some space, put some machines in. But like I said, we're trying to make more chocolate, and we're trying to make it more efficiently, like any business would. But we actually want this chocolate to beat our current chocolate and blind taste test. So what we've done is, for every single step of the process, and there are a lot of steps, we have gone out and tested different machinery, done blind taste tests. I mean, Greg's half the time he's sourcing beans, the other half the time he's in Italy looking at machines, you know, trying
it's
to
a
do
tough
work.
Life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you need an assistant?
A sorcerer's apprentice.
Yeah, but so we're just, you know, because there are lots of different ways to make chocolate. And everyone thinks that whatever machinery they happen to use is the one that makes the best chocolate. But we've sort of put that to the test and said, okay, let's sort of open our minds. Let's see all the different ways. Let's enumerate them. And then let's try them. And we do blind taste tests. And sometimes we have to use very modern ones. So we now have a machine that for the new factory will actually sort the beans for us. It actually has cameras and jets of air. And we've actually gotten to the point where in blind taste tests, it can beat the flavor of a human sorting the beans. So that's a huge win. But on the other end of the spectrum, we have machinery that's over 100 years old that sat in a farm in Switzerland, and we're still trying to get the hay out of the gears and get it refurbished. So we're just doing what works, and it's a long, long process, and hopefully soon we'll have something to show for it.
That's so exciting, though. When you are growing cacao plants... When you're growing cacao plants in your house and roasting beans on your stovetop, did it ever cross your mind that it could be this big for you?
I think it's the same answer then it is now. I think it's just fun.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun. And it's chocolate's the type of thing that makes people happy. And it's really nice to work out something that makes people happy. In previous life, I and Greg, a lot of people on the team worked on software. And no one ever came in and said how much they loved our software and how it's changing their lives. You know, but everyone comes in every day and says, I love your chocolate and it makes me happy. And so it's kind of fun to be part of something that is just is almost like selling happiness in a way.
So, Greg, you started with the company when?
2012.
And you are the sorcerer.
I am
the
sorcerer.
Don't get it confused the with sorcerer. The sorcerer.
No, no, he's
you
the sorcerer.
You are the sorcerer.
No, I'm the sorcerer.
So, how did you get into cocoa bean sourcing? Please, I think everyone here wants to know. How do you bust into a job that allows you to travel all over the world, hike through, like, tropical mountainous regions, and taste chocolate?
You know, it's funny that you ask that because I get that question all the time. It's like, that's all anyone wants to know is like, so how do I get your job?
Yeah, seriously.
Which always sounds vaguely threatening, to be honest. Like, you know,
I just want to be an apprentice. Okay. I don't want to unseat you.
Well, no problem. then we're cool. Honestly, where it came from was as I joined Dandelion, we needed someone to be responsible for the cacao side of things or the bean side of things. And because all we do is two ingredient chocolate, we use the same sugar all the time. We love our sugar. I've gone and visited where the sugar comes from as well. But it means the beans become this super important aspect to it. And so it means we have to put a lot of time and attention into getting great beans because we do light roasts. The flavor of the beans really comes through. And so you can't hide behind anything. If the beans don't taste good, the chocolate doesn't taste good, period. And as we were doing that, we also realized over time that the world of chocolate makers is expanding. And, you know, I think different origins of cocoa beans become sort of popular or trendy, et cetera. But I think what we wanted to do is make sure we were always kind of finding the thing that worked best for our chocolate, regardless of whether it was trendy or new or interesting, just something that tasted good. I think my background in tech was product management. So I was always about building relationships with people. And so I think a lot of people see sourcing as this, like, you go into the jungle, you got a machete. I do have a machete somewhere. But you got it, with a machete, you're hacking down some vines, you see a cocoa tree, you pluck off a pod, you crack it open, you eat a bean, and you're like, that's the one? We're going to make chocolate, people. And then the helicopter comes in and pulls the tree out or something like that.
It doesn't look like that.
I'm sorry. We can go now. But the reality is it's about people, right? It's about going and building relationships with people, figuring out who you trust enough to give $70,000 to, and they're going to ship a container full of cocoa beans to you. You know, it's because the flavor side of things, we bring beans back and we have 20 different people taste them. And so we can sort of get an understanding and analysis of the flavor more easily than you can figure out who do you want to partner with, because we want to work with people for decades to come. We don't want to say, hey, we're buying these beans now, good luck selling them next year. We want to really build a partnership and a relationship with
people. you form relationships with farmers because A, that's best, and you want to know who's growing your beans, but B, a very important part of the chocolate process is the fermentation and drying.
You know so much about chocolate.
You know what? I'm just prompting you to just go off.
I mean, I think there's a little bit of this is trying to pitch yourself as the apprentice, and I appreciate that.
Two birds, one stone.
and honestly, any company is going to do better if it's a win-win. You know, if instead of, we're getting good cocoa beans, but someone else is, we're taking advantage of somebody, that's not sustainable. And I don't mean sustainable in the, like, trendy use of the word. I mean, like, literally sustainable as it can be sustained for many, many years. So our attitude is everyone should be able to win in this. You know, they can have better livelihoods because they have a more consistent partnership with us. We're paying better prices. And, you know, they're happy. We're happy because we get good and consistent beans. We know what's going on, you know, and we don't have to worry about where the ingredient for our single product is coming from for years to come. And so I think it means that, like, everyone wins in those situations.
Would it ever be, is it common or completely unheard of, you find a plantation that grows beautiful beans, but maybe you don't really dig the way they're fermenting them. You don't like the setup they have. What do you do? Do you do anything, or do you just walk on down the road and find something else?
This is actually just last week. So one of the things that is also my job is to get to know other people in the industry that we can work with to make things better all around. And so there's a fermentation specialist named Dan O'Doherty from Hawaii. He's sort of world renowned. And he does a great job on this stuff. And so there were these guys we met in India, Karthik and Manoj. And we really love these guys. They did an awesome job with the agricultural side of things, and the beans sometimes tasted good, which is typically like, okay, now fermentation's a little like, you know, you got to get more consistent. And so we worked with another company, Meridian Cacao, to bring Dan out there to help them with all their fermentation, so that they could sort of learn from an expert on this. Get good consistent fermentation, and I think we're going to get samples next week from the end result of that process. So a lot of it comes down to, like, if we think someone has good potential, and this means that, like, they want to work with us, they're willing to put the hard work in that it takes, that they care as much about the cacao as we care about the chocolate, then, you know, we're willing to invest in it and put some time and energy into try to make it happen.
Where are the most oh, I hate to say that. Where are you most excited about? Like, where the beans are coming from? Like, what locales are you most excited about right now?
So I think the ones from India would actually be really, really cool and interesting, because a lot of people don't. India produces 10,000 metric tons a year, but it currently all goes to Mondelez, which is the confectionery branch of Kraft Foods, and so they actually. They refer to them as Cadbury trees or something. They, like, have a name in India that they don't, like, even call them cocoa trees. I think they call them Cadbury trees or something like that. But anyway,
is that the bean that grows in Africa? What's the name of
Forastero?
It?
Forastero.
Forastero. The beans they have there are actually sort of a genetic hybrid. And so one of the things we're actually working on now is getting genetic testing for all the different beans. More out of curiosity than anything else. You know, if a bean tastes good, it tastes good. The genetics of it contribute to that, as do fermentation and drying. So we're all about, like, let's look at the end result. Let's figure out who we want to work with. And then we can worry about the inputs, such as what are the genetics and stuff like that later. But the other place I'm excited about, working with these really cool guys in Tanzania, Coco Camilli, really like them. Working with this group in Belize called My Mountain Cacao. Belize produces like 80 tons, maybe 100 tons of cocoa a year, which is, so it's super tiny. Even for the Caribbean, it's super, like, Caribbean, Central America, it's super tiny. But they make really good beans. If you see a bar out there that says Belize on it, give it a try.
Pick it up.
Yeah, pick it up. If you see a bar out there that says India on it, call me and let me know where you found it, because I'm curious about it. So, yeah, and then, you know, we've started talking to a group in Fiji, which I think would be really cool. And I'm not just choosing places that I just want to go visit.
Yeah, seriously.
You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, oh, yeah, and I'm pretty sure Club Med has beans.
I mean, I've been to Venezuela so many times. Who needs to get those beans anymore?
there's actually a lot of really cool, interesting, exciting people we're starting to work with. Oh, and the Agricultural Institute in Honduras, we're really trying to figure out a way to work with them. They grow a lot of cacao that they just sell to other, they sell the trees, you know, so they have a gene bank, which a gene bank sounds like it's a steel vault with little drawers in it with
like the one in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just okay. We got the
seed
mind
bank.
Link. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. No, it turns out a gene bank in cacao means a farm with a lot of trees on it of different genetics.
That makes sense. I guess.
No, it's
but they could cross pollinate and some weird stuff could happen.
Can and do. And that is where the great cocoa monster of 1978 came from. It's not a thing. I was just making it up. I know.
You
looked so excited when I said
story.
That. Oh, man.
So, Todd, from a chocolate maker's point of view, exciting beans. Like, what are you excited about from making chocolate? Like, what are you... And what are the different... You know, are there some, like, specific differences on, like, how different... Like, do beans from Madagascar behave in a different way than the beans from India, than the beans from Tanzania, than... Venezuela.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's a great question. I mean, as Greg said, I think we're sort of equal opportunity bean samplers. You know, I think there's some people in the industry who say, oh, I won't even look at these beans because there's no way they could be good. Or they'll cut them open and say, oh, you know, I don't like the way they look inside. But generally unless it's like, you know, completely damaged or has moths or whatever, we'll generally take in samples from anywhere. We'll try them out. And it is true that the beans have different flavors. Chocolate can actually have more flavor complexity than wine or coffee. But I think all the big companies for so long have seen that as a defect. It was a flaw. It was something to get rid of. It was something to roast out of the beans. It was something to cover over with vanilla or a lot of cocoa butter or different flavors and inclusions. And I think for us, we're just saying we're just going to add sugar. And in some cases, you know, usually it's 70% or 30% sugar. We make some bars that are 100%, so no sugar, just the bean itself. You know, unlike other 100% bars that may have other additives that kind of cover the flavor, we're just trying to give you the flavor of the bean. And so generally speaking, like a Madagascar bar will often be very, very fruity. But the thing that's most fascinating and interesting is that, you know, we've worked with this farm in Madagascar, a guy named Bertil Akison, for years now. And every year we've gotten a new harvest from Madagascar. And every year it has tasted fruity. But every year the fruit taste has been different. You know, one year was more like cherries, another year like strawberries, some years like raisins. And so rather than work really hard to make all the bars taste exactly the same and say the 2014 Madagascar is the same as the 2015 Madagascar, we're going to blend and we're going to add vanilla and we're going to, you know, sort of mute it. We just say, nope, let's get the best flavor we can out of it. And, you know, if you really like the one that tastes like cherries and that was last year, it's like, sorry, I should have bought more of that. You know, we just put on the label, this is how they're different. So I think we're treating it more like wine. And so because of that, we have to go and find these interesting flavors. And, you know, sometimes we find beans that are actually really good, but maybe they're too similar to something we already use, or they're not the right exact flavor for us. And we'll even sell beans that we bought to other chocolate makers, and they can make great chocolate out of it, maybe very different than us, very different in our style. So we're just always on the hunt for kind of what works for us.
Your chocolate is, I mean, I had your Madagascar bar. I had Megan Giller on.
We just saw Megan 2 days ago.
She's wonderful.
She's awesome.
Hi, Megan. hope you're listening. But she brought your Madagascar bar.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, Megan, you're the best.
She did. And I was just like, oh, my God, this bar tastes so good. It's so fruity. And I used to hate fruity bars because the fruitiest bars I ever had were just like garbage chocolate, and I'm not going to give any names, but garbage chocolate. Okay, so you not only do you make highly sought after bars out of a small warehouse, you're trying to scale up. You have a cafe in Tokyo, and you have a cafe in the San Francisco Ferry Building. Am I missing a cafe?
Trying to remember. No,
I was going to say, like, are there more? Oh my God,
am I missing something?
Not yet. Yeah, give us a little while. But.
So you. Will you give just some examples of some really interesting things that you're doing with chocolate and like chocolate drinks out of that cafe? Because, I mean...
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, when we created this company, we did it not because we did like market research and said, hey, this is, you know, this is what's going to work in spreadsheets. It's like we really wanted this to exist. And, you know, every time I go on a trip, and I know Greg does the same thing, I go to every chocolate shop, every cupcake shop, every dessert shop, and check it out and see the experience. And I'm always sort of like, oh, you know, I would like this, or I want it a little different. And I think that one of the challenges with chocolate shops is that you often see people take sort of a packaged food product and try to say, oh, put it on a plate, so now it's like an elevated experience. And I think for me, experiencing chocolate when it's in sort of, it's been prepared for you in sort of a warm, you know, like a drink or a cake or something like that, is that experience can be better than sort of when you, you know, you're just presented with the chocolate bar and you're just supposed to eat it right there. And so, you know, because, you know, the other thing is there used to be hundreds of years ago or 100 years ago, coffee houses and chocolate houses. And all of the coffee houses, there's Starbucks everywhere. There's no chocolate houses anymore. And so we wanted to bring some of that back. So if you come to San Francisco and you come to our cafe, you not only can you see the whole chocolate process, chocolate being made, but we have a couple different types of hot chocolate. We have sort of, you know, sort of Swiss Miss style, but made with good ingredients. We have European style. And we had big debates, like, should this be more like a French style or a Spanish style? You know, is it, how dense is it going to be? How thick is it going to be? You know, we did, you know, all the same crazy blind taste tests we do on the chocolate bars, we did on the drink. So we actually roast the beans differently for how we want the drinks to taste because we do an end-to-end test. A lot of our drinks, we actually have to make a ganache and let it sit overnight because we did taste tests and found out that makes a better hot chocolate. We also have single origin brownie flights. So you can get a brownie bite in three different origins and, you know, maybe you don't want to try it in dark chocolate, you can try it in brownie form. We also have our chef's tasting, which is five mini desserts. Every little sort of treat is a different origin, a different flavor profile. And so our pastry chef, she actually, you know, for one of the flavors she wanted 100% Madagascar, super strong flavor, one that we had tried and said, we're not going to put that in a bar. It's not going to work. So she actually in the kitchen sort of went rogue and made her own chocolate to make in the desserts.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So like the chef in our own chocolate factory went rogue to make her own chocolate for the desserts to get the flavor that she wanted. So we're just kind of like experimenting and playing and trying to have this awesome experience.
That's so, I mean, when you just come to a place, come from a place of pure creativity, just so much wonderful magic happens. When are you going to put out a cookbook?
Have we announced that yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Next year.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're working on it. Right
yeah.
Now.
It's currently right being written and taste tested.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Thank you. Are you putting those delicious graham crackers in there? Or no.
I think we got a lot of.
Please.
I'm trying to remember.
It's probably. If not, we'll put it in for you.
I love those graham crackers. So, Todd, Greg, thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with the morning after quiz.
Love quizzes.
Americans throw away 58 billion disposable cups every year. A lot of those cups will still be around long after you're dead. Kind of dark, I know, but I'm Greg from Kapow, and we decided to do something about it. We created the only glass travel mug that's 100% US made. You can check it out alongside our complete line of everyday reusables at kapow.com, CUPPOW.com.
Welcome back to the Morning After, and it's time for the Morning After quiz. Boys, gentlemen, look, this is the least important quiz of your life, but I'm gonna run it down for you, okay? Even though you're two successful chocolatiers, this is your second career. Your roots are in Silicon Valley, and you know all about that. But what do you know about silicone breast implants? That was rhetorical. I'm going to ask you three multiple choice questions, and you can answer individually or by committee.
Committee.
There's no money on the line here. Are you ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
Okay. Number one, Brian Zembic, a Canadian magician and professional high-stakes gambler, bet his friend $100,000 that he'd get breast implants. He won the bet and has kept the implants in for almost 20 years because why? A, he likes the attention he gets from people on the street and charges strangers $5 each to touch them. B, he unknowingly entered, he unknowingly entered into a particular niche fetish where women idolize men with large breasts, and he likes it. C, as a part of the bet, his friend must pay him $10,000 for every year he keeps them. What is it?
Let's do this committee talk.
I was thinking A.
I was thinking A. It sounds like the kind of thing someone would do, like $5 a group. You know?
Yeah, but I don't think someone would pay someone $10,000 a year.
Yeah, that seems like the worst bet. If so, I want to make a bet with that guy. let's go with A.
Yeah, I think A.
It's C. His friend has to pay him $10,000 a year for every year he can. And he's like, I'm used to him by now, and I get $10,000 a year just for having these things on my chest.
Wow.
He got size 36C, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah,
no joke.
Yeah.
We're not talking about ant bites. All right. Sandy Canesco of Sydney, Australia, did what after her husband, Dustin, died in a car crash? A, because he paid for her breast augmentation surgery and admired the work so much, she buried him with breast implants, one in each hand. B, had his ashes sewn into her breast implants so he'll always be close to her heart. Or C, because of his love of large breasts, she started a fund in his name to help small-chested women of little means get implants.
Was little means a joke?
Yeah.
So I believe I've read this before.
Really? Okay.
And I believe it's B.
Really? Because I was going to say, finding a doctor to do that.
Remember, though, Todd, this is
Australia.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. Maybe it was a dream. Maybe in a dream I had, like, I heard. But I think I read this story.
I guess you would get sued there, like, in America. Like, you couldn't do that in America.
I'm feeling strongly B.
All right, let's do B.
You're right. It's B.
Yes, I don't. Yeah.
All right, you guys. Last one. If you don't hear about breast implants saving lives, but that's exactly what happened to a Los Angeles woman. How did this happen? A, when hiking in the desert, she stopped to sit and rest when a rattlesnake lunged and bit her in the breast. Her implant took most of the venom and was the reason why she survived the long trip to the hospital for the antivenom. B, her double D breast implant stopped a bullet millimeters away from penetrating her heart in a drive-by shooting. Or C, in a real-life open water situation, she was snorkeling off the coast of Mexico only to find, when she got back to the location of the boat, it had left without her. She survived 9 hours in the Caribbean Sea, floating on her back, the buoyancy of her large breast implants assisting her so she wouldn't have to exert too much energy.
So I saw the Mythbusters on what can stop a bullet.
Who knew that Greg was an expert on this topic?
So I don't think it can. I don't think they can stop a bullet. I feel confident on what can stop a bullet.
So not okay.
I don't think breast implant can.
So between A and C.
Yeah.
Now, are they really more buoyant?
Well, so I saw Mythbusters. No, I didn't actually have Mythbusters on that. I don't know. I assume not.
Because there's saline. That's salt water.
Exactly.
So. Or it could have been silicone. Like, some women still have the silicone, old school silicone.
It could be old school.
And you don't know. And you don't know when this happened,
yeah,
by the way.
Point. It's a fair point.
I don't know. I'm thinking A, but...
I'm thinking A, too.
All right. All right, we're going to go with A.
It's B.
Oh! Mythbusters, you let me down. That's why they went off the air.
Well, you know, she probably wasn't shot point blank. You know, could have been stray, could have been losing its speed as a bullet, you know, air resistance and all that. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
This is amazing.
Todd Sonis and Greg D'Alessandro of Dandelion Chocolate. It was a wonderful pleasure to have you in the studio. And keep making delicious chocolate for us to eat.
We'll do our best.
This is Leslie Stockton's Morning After.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization.
To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.